If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God. This is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings, starting May 8th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Coming home to Wyoming, it still feels like an adventure. It still feels big and wild and raw. There's a lot of these little jewels sitting out there that not a lot of people know about. They bring you closer to something bigger than yourself.
Discover why Academy Award-winning director and climber Jimmy Chin still calls Wyoming home. And plan your adventure at TravelWyoming.com.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. What was life like in a women's prison in 19th century Ireland? Well, today's guest, Elaine Farrell, has been delving into the prison records to find out. Based at Queen's University Belfast, Elaine has been researching women's experiences of incarceration and what they can tell us about life in Ireland at the time for a new book, Women, Crime and Punishment in Ireland, Life in the 19th Century Convict Prison. I spoke to her to find out more. So you've been researching the experience of women in Irish prisons, and we're looking at the post-famine period here, which is broadly the second half of the 19th century. Sounds like a really fascinating subject. So what are some of the new insights that you've uncovered with your research?
I'm so glad that you've kind of picked up on that idea of women's experiences, because I suppose when you're looking at a prison, for me, I was less interested in maybe that prison building kind of justice system that got the women there, and much more interested in the women's experiences and their lives before they got into prison, their experiences in prison, and then even sometimes their experiences afterwards. So for me, you know, kind of thinking about what are the kind of main findings from the book, I was just so fascinated by the women's lives. I kind of feel like, you know, through their prison records, and these records are held in the National Archives of Ireland in Dublin, through those records, we can really get a kind of a sense of women's survival strategies. As you've said, this is post-famine Ireland, when, you know, thinking about the famine, there would have been such starvation, a lot of migration as well. We can, through these, the prison records, we can see that story of emigration, because we have files that give addresses of where the women in prison were writing to. So we know that they have children who are going to Britain, who are going to the US, who are going to Canada and beyond. And we can also really see opportunism here. You know, there's women's agency there. They're choosing to commit crimes. And it just offers so much of an insight into their lives, kind of domestic abuse, motherhood, all sorts of topics.
So what types of women found themselves incarcerated? What kind of families and backgrounds did they come from? And also, what kind of crimes landed them in prison?
So as part of the project, I built a database of the files, because I wanted to try to track exactly that. So I probably have around 3,500, just over 3,500 women in that database. And I suppose that they're coming from all sorts of backgrounds, and the crimes they're committing are quite varied. So the sentence could range from 3 years to 20. And I should say that, you know, this is, I'm writing about a convict prison, which is the prison for serious offenders. So it would be different to a local prison where somebody might go for a day or two because they were drunk or kind of picked up for kind of petty crime. So the women who are going to the convict prison are those kind of serious offenders. They're getting 3 years is the minimum they could get, but it could go right up to 20 years. There's even women who would have been sentenced to death, but they had their sentence commuted to a term of imprisonment instead. So they were kind of saved from the hangman's noose. So the average sentence is around 5.5 years. They could get out a little bit early because of if they were, you know, well behaved behind bars. There was that bit of incentive for them to behave. In terms of the crimes, then, it's overwhelming. Theft related offences. So it could be stealing from the person, breaking into a house, it could be pickpocketing. But there are, women are in prison for violent offences as well. You know, there's infant murder, infanticide as it would have been called. There's murder, there's manslaughter, there's kidnapping in there. There's a couple of women who are in for assisting in rape. And sometimes it's pretty clear that the judges are kind of exasperated. Here's a woman coming in again and again for a theft offence. And because she now has so many prior offences, she's going to be sentenced to a much longer term of imprisonment.
And does that emphasis on theft, is that because there was a lot of poverty? Is that why people were stealing?
I mean, it can be. So for many of the women, most definitely it is. It's a survival strategy. You know, sometimes it's stealing livestock. Sometimes it's stealing clothing, which they're then going to pawn. So that they can then raise money to, you know, pay for food for their families. I could give you an example of a case where I think there's kind of a survival strategy going on, but there's also other factors. And it's one of my favourite cases in the sample, if we're, you know, allowed to have favourites amongst all those thousands of women. But it was this woman, Mary Enright. And I knew a lot about Mary Enright before I actually knew how her story ended, I suppose. So I kind of got pretty attached to her. She was born in London and she was first convicted in Dublin in 1881 for stealing two dresses. And she got 2 months in a local prison. She got married to a man in Limerick, and then they had several children and they moved to Dublin. And she has a kind of a string of theft offences. You know, it's usually stealing clothing. And I think it's because both her and her husband have a background in tailoring. So this clothing kind of seems to be connected to the occupation as well. So she has, from what I can see, she has around 8 offences in the 1880s and 1890s. And then eventually in 1896, she's sentenced to the convict prison. So she's sentenced to 3 years. She steals silk from a draper's shop in Dublin. So she heads off to the convict prison. And the reason I know so much about her is because of all those details. So she's born in London. And so when I'm trying to track people down, a woman called Mary Enright, which is a relatively unusual surname, but being born in London, I can clearly identify that this is the same woman. And also because she had several children, she's showing up in kind of birth records. So she's imprisoned in 1896, and then she's discharged in February 1898 on early release. So because she has been well behaved behind bars, she gets out early and she goes back to her family. But 3 months later, she's back in court again, now charged with stealing a shirt. So we can really see there, you know, it's like once somebody's stealing something, then they're kind of coming back into prison again. She gets 3 months for that offence. But now, because she has breached the term of her early release, she now has to serve that local prison stay, but she now has to go back to the convict prison to serve out the time that was left when she got that early release. And at this point, she writes a petition. And I do have some of these kind of petitions in the records, you know, where it's these women's own voices. And that really gives a kind of a glimpse of what their lives were like, or their feelings, or their personality. And I'll just read you, it's quite a long petition, but I'll just read you a couple of lines from it, if that's okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
She says, "I'm a married woman and the mother of a large family. My whole thought was to reform and be a good mother to my dear children, to think of how anxious I was to make up for all the sufferings they endured during my absence, and how I hoped and prayed that nothing would ever separate me from them again. I'm not able to describe my poor darlings have no one belonging to them in Dublin to mind them but strangers. Their father is a man that takes drink and does not seem to know the wants of children further than food. To describe the state of dirt and wretchedness of my poor darlings and my home we're in is almost impossible. The thought of them and the remorse and sorrow for what I've done nearly at times drives me insane." And I just feel like it's heartbreaking. You know, it's there's the heartache, the guilt, the anxiety there. And at this time, the family are living in Dublin City in a really congested area of Dublin City. They're living in a tenement house with several other families. And the petition, you know, although it convinced me, it didn't convince the authorities. So she still has to serve out her time in prison. And so she gets out. But less than a year later, she's back again, you know, charged with her daughters now for stealing clothing again. And so she has another prison filed because she goes back to the convict prison on a new charge. And it was, you know, I knew this file existed and I was going to the National Archives in Dublin to get this file to see, you know, what's the next chapter of Mary Enright's life. At this stage, you know, by the kind of early 20th century, when you open up a prison file, you get photographs. So there's mugshots now of the women. So there's a mugshot when they come in and there's a mugshot when they come out. And I could see, I opened it up, I saw the photographs and I knew she's in for several offences. There's several photographs in that file. But I noticed that one photograph was missing and it was the discharge photograph. So what had happened is in the early 1900s, she had a string of offences and she went into prison for the last time in 1906 and her discharge photograph was missing, which immediately told me that kind of answered that she had actually died in prison and she was only 51 years of age. So it was quite a sad story. And I really just kind of feel like that petition and her file and her repeated thefts, it really shows us that, you know, there's kind of a survival strategy there. But also she says herself that at times, you know, when she went into the shop that she was drunk and she was tempted by the goods on display. And this is clearly a woman who has a problem with alcohol. Her husband also seems to have issues with alcohol. There's no kind of support network there. And she's trying to raise this family where there's gendered expectations that, you know, the care of the children falls to the mother. So there's all sorts of things going on in Mary Enright's life. And I think that case file just gives us a bit of an insight into the reality, into these lived experiences for women who ended up in prison.
So moving on, in fact, to those experiences of women in prison, can you give us a sense of what convict prisons were like at this time? What, say, for example, would a daily routine be like?
Yes. So the daily routine in prison, there was lots of different aspects to it in terms of there's this clear sense that a prison should be to punish somebody for the crime that they have committed, but also to reform them. So it's kind of like get them into the prison and essentially cure them so that when they go out, that they're not going to commit the crime again. But we can see that there's a kind of a gendered aspect to this as well, because there's a sense that when women are coming into prison, that they're going to be cured and that when they leave prison, they're actually then going to kind of educate their families. So this is nearly like by investing in the woman coming into the convict prison, it's nearly like then the family, the children are going to be cured and they're, you know, that it's not going to be this kind of hereditary criminality. So officials bring in kind of a system. There's schooling, reading, writing, arithmetic. There's geography as well that's taught. Work is an important aspect of the day. So for women that involved needlework, there's laundry work. For a couple of years, there's shoemaking going on as well. The women are making uniforms for the prison residents, but they're also making uniforms for the Irish police force and for other groups. And they also, when through this work, the women were earning money, which would then be paid in installments to them after they get out of prison. I suppose it's kind of instilling in women this idea that you work and then you get something in return. And it also means that the women have money when they're released and they don't have to essentially steal for their first meals. Religion is also extremely important. And there's Protestant and Catholic services in the prison, kind of weekly as well as on Sundays. Exercise is seen as important, that kind of walking around for an hour a day, that idea of fresh air being good for the mind and body. And then sometimes, you know, women committed offences as well when they're behind bars. And an offence could be something, you know, it could be something very serious, like they attacked, say, a prison matron, as they would have been called, the staff member, or maybe they attacked another inmate. And it could also be other things that are quite trivial, you know, like sometimes not eating, or it can also be talking out of turn, or, you know, that kind of behaviour. And so there would be punishments, bread and water, diet was given as a punishment. Sometimes they would lose marks, and they were earning marks to get out of prison early. So losing the marks meant that, you know, that would have an impact there. And if somebody was violent, there were some restraints could be used, you know, kind of muffs or something like a straitjacket. And women were also expected to wear uniforms when they were behind bars. And I suppose in many ways, what the officials want to do is they want this kind of uniform system, you know, that women are kind of behaving all in this regular way. Every hour of the day is accounted for. But through the records, and I suppose through the punishment records, I can kind of see where women are, you know, they're kind of expressing their own personalities. They're maybe taking advantage of some things, you know, where they have to wear the uniform, but then some of the women are in trouble because they've been embellishing their uniforms or making their hems a little bit shorter or whatever else, and taking the starch out of their caps so that they're not as rigid.
That sounds a bit like, you know, people adapting their school uniforms, isn't it?
Exactly, Ellie. And, you know, there's a couple of people who come to the prison, because the women's prison in Ireland, in Mountjoy, when it opens in 1858, it's really held up as this kind of nearly like a model prison around the world, because it's women, it's just for women prisoners, and there's women staff as well, and a woman who's managing the prison. So there's international visitors sometimes who come, and one of them comes from the States, Charles Coffin, and in his records he describes how sometimes these offences, as they're called, behind bars, you know, these misdeeds that the women are doing, he says that it's a bit like schoolgirls, that they're being punished for these really trivial offences, like talking out of turn. So I think, you know, it's exactly what you're saying. You know, there is that kind of echo of school going on there.
Do we have any sense from any of your sources about women's attitudes towards prison? Was it purely seen as punitive, or did some women, for example, get something from it? I'm imagining, for example, women who might have come from abusive or unstable backgrounds, perhaps this environment wouldn't always be negative? Or is that me trying to see a silver lining where there is none?
I mean, you know, sometimes I'm the same. I'm kind of like, I don't want to make this seem like a lovely place to be. But at the same time, you are right that for some people, you know, it was nearly like, here's somewhere to stay. Here's a nearly like a refuge, exactly from what you're saying, from that kind of abuse. And I think the women's reactions to getting this prison sentence, to going to the convict prison, really differed. And it just depended entirely on what their circumstances were like. I suppose their personalities as well. So some women are kind of screaming, crying in court when they hear that they're being sentenced to the convict prison. There's one woman, Anne Lynch, and she hears in 1870 that she has been sentenced to 7 years for theft. She's in County Tyrone. And in reaction, she actually kicks the prison governor's thigh as he's trying to lead her out of court. So he's trying to take her away, and here she kicks his thigh. And honestly, Ellie, I'm sure she was aiming for somewhere else, but she got his thigh anyway. Then she hit the policeman in the face as she tried to hit another. And all the while, she's holding a baby in her arms. So this is like a really strong reaction to her prison sentence. But for others, they seem entirely different. You know, the journalists are there kind of reporting the reaction. And they say, you know, that the woman kind of didn't express any emotion at her sentence. And some of them just seem entirely blasé about it. And I think it's because, especially for those women who have been there before, it's nearly like, in a way, they're institutionalized. If they're not in the convict prison, then maybe they would be in another institution, like a workhouse, or maybe they would be in a local prison. So there is some of the women that I have in the records, they, you know, they do have kind of a, they've come from a string of different institutions. So for them, having to stay in an institution for another 3 years wouldn't be, I suppose, when they're kind of looking at that, it doesn't seem quite as bad as maybe for women who are being, you know, that they're the sole provider for their children and they're being taken away from everything that they have ever known.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
They have set up home. They are being a good wife. They are being a good mother. And they're trying to, of course, get their money that they have earned through their work in prison.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
I will return to that point about providing for children in a little bit, but you mentioned earlier female guards. So do we have any sense of the relationship that was intended between guards and prisoners? Was it meant to be antagonistic or was it meant to be more cooperative? And do we have any sense of how that actually played out in reality?
Yeah, so I suppose the relationship in theory was supposed to be very much like the staff are essentially model women. And that the prisoners would kind of look up to these women as, you know, here's a good example of what a woman looks like. But it can be hard to, the officials found it sometimes quite hard to find women who were willing to work in a prison who had that kind of background. So they're also kind of thinking, oh, in an ideal world, it would be, you know, maybe lower middle class women who would be working in the prison and who would be well educated, who would be refined in manner and all that. But that wasn't always the reality. And so what actually happens? Yes, there's antagonism. Yes, there are staff members who are attacked, you know, physically as assaulted, suffer really bad injuries. Sometimes they have to leave work because they, you know, that they're not able or they're so traumatized about it. But there are also cases, which surprised me, of this kind of close relationship between the women who are being imprisoned and the staff members whose task is to essentially control them and lock them in. And we can see that coming out sometimes in the staff files of, you know, kind of misbehavior. So it'll be things like there's a staff member who gave a prisoner a set of keys to go to do an errand for her. But actually, those keys could have.
Doesn't seem very wise.
Exactly. But you know, that she had kind of built up that trust with the prisoner, and the prisoner didn't do anything. She did the errand that she was supposed to do and brought the keys back and everything. But this was found out. And there's other cases where staff members are giving certain prisoners the best food. There's clearly a strong relationship going on. I have a couple of letters from this woman called Anne Cunningham, and she was a former inmate, and she's writing back to her sister, who's behind bars. And she says to her in the letter, she, you know, because she knows that the letter is being read by the staff members as well. So she's nearly writing to the staff members at the same time as she's writing to her sister. And she's writing from New York. And in the letter, she kind of says, you know, send my best to these staff members, send my best to these staff members. And she also talks about other prisoners, you know, this. So the friendships weren't just between kind of staff and inmates, that kind of relationship, but actually across with the inmates themselves. And that idea of, you know, kind of asking for somebody or expressing sometimes some other women, they express regret when they hear that a staff member's parent has died, or, you know, it just seems like that these staff members are there for years and the prisoners are there for years. And so these kind of relationships were nearly inevitable that developed between them.
So it's definitely not black and white. On the point about relationships between the prisoners, this is something I wanted to ask you about, because I think often in the kind of popular perception of prison, primarily prison films and TV and stuff, it's often shown as very hierarchical. You know, you've got to make friends with the right people in prison to stay safe. Do we have any sense that it was like this in these women's prisons, or was that not really the case?
So I'm totally fascinated by the friendships behind bars. The whole chapter that I have in the book that's about this idea of these kind of friendships and these relationships. And again, I don't want to overshadow how bad it was by kind of saying, you know, oh, they're all friends behind bars. You know, it was a really, really difficult life being kind of taken away from family and from children. It definitely wasn't an easy place to live. But there is this kind of sense coming out that there's also a bit of socializing taking place behind bars. There's notes being written in library books. There's notes being written on toilet paper for others. There's reports of laughter and singing, clearly showing that there's some kind of friendships going on. There's a report of a Punch and Judy show that goes on one night. And some inmates do decide to stay together after release. And I think that shows the kind of extent of the bonds. So that woman, Anne Cunningham, that I mentioned, who was in New York and she was writing back to her sister in prison, she had actually, in her letters, she reveals that she has actually helped two other inmates who came to New York, and she has actually been able to essentially find them jobs, or she gave them a place to stay for a while until they were able to find a job. So in a way, Anne Cunningham, who was a former prisoner herself, is nearly taking on that role of this kind of prison aid society, you know, kind of helping women after release. And she also pleads for the release of a woman called Catherine Hennessy, who had been in prison for years for killing the child of another woman. And so Catherine Hennessy is an older woman. And she has spent years, but I mean, she's in there since the 1850s. But Anne Cunningham sends in the 1870s, Anne Cunningham writes back, you know, sending, requesting that Catherine Hennessy be released and just put on a boat and to come and join her in New York. So clearly this relationship had developed. In terms of the hierarchy, it's so difficult to figure out who's at the top of the hierarchy. And I think it's because I have the records of those who got caught. So I know who got caught for this kind of misbehaviour. I think the women who are at the top of the hierarchy are the ones that are most unlikely to get caught. And they're the ones who will have been protected. But what I do have is there's so many cases behind bars of goods being found, you know, tobacco is found. There's food found that isn't the type of food that's given out in the prison. So there's some kind of goods networks that's kind of working on the outside, and these goods are coming into the prison and all this sort of contraband that's coming in. So sometimes women will be caught with it, and then other times it's clear that it's being passed around. So there's most definitely all those kind of networks going behind bars, but who's at the top of it, I just don't know.
Well, how much were prisoners connected with the outside world? So obviously people were getting in some kind of goods, but I'm also thinking about something you mentioned earlier, which is women being cut off from being able to provide for their families and their children. Were they allowed any contact with children, for example?
So they were allowed some contact, but it is definitely limited. So it depended on what position they were in the prison system. So as they were better behaved and they're kind of getting towards the end of their sentence, they're allowed a few more privileges. What that means is that rather than getting, you know, a letter kind of every 6 months, you're entitled to a letter every 3 months. So it's, you know, that's the the kind of reality. So yes, they could write letters at intervals. Children could write letters, and again, they would be given to them at intervals. So it's not kind of as many as they want. And they were also allowed visitors. And again, it's, you know, kind of a half hour visit at set intervals. But the problem with the visits is that the prison in Dublin catered for the whole island of Ireland. So it is not easy for somebody who lives on the other side of the island to be able to travel to Dublin for this visit. I can see that in some of the letters that I have that survive in the records, where, you know, some of the individuals are saying, you know, it's not easy to get there, or that, you know, that they have to care for somebody at home and so they can't leave them. So there's a financial implication there as well as time, you know, somebody who can take the time away from work to actually go and visit. So what I can see is that the women who are from Dublin City, whose family, husbands are within easy reach of the prison, they do get these kind of visitors at intervals, sometimes around Christmas time, as well as that kind of, you know, Christmas visit. But for women who are, you know, whose family maybe, you know, sometimes there's going to be a sense of shame there, this idea that maybe they don't want to maintain a connection either. But there's also that kind of financial and time implication for those who are living just too far away from the prison.
And so there weren't any formal provisions or systems in place for the children of women who were put in prison. Would it just be see who they can place them with, really?
Yes, it depended on the time period. So actually, at the beginning in the 1850s, so the prison was set up in the wake of transportation. So when transportation is no longer available, the women are going to prison where in previous decades they would have been transported. So in the 1850s, when it's established initially, children are actually coming into prison with their mothers. So when they're quite young, they would be coming in with their mothers. But this means, because the mothers have quite long sentences, that the children are now growing up in prison. So you end up with children, you know, kind of 7, 8 years old behind bars, because they were either sometimes born in the prison or they have been brought in. Because there was nobody else to take care of them. So this becomes a concern for the officials, because they're concerned that potentially they're encouraging children to be criminal if they're growing up in the prison, and that, you know, there's a concern that they're boasting about their mother's crimes and that this isn't quite what the prison was supposed to be. So eventually, in the late 1860s, they do bring in the regulations that the children have, you know, infants can come in, and children who are born will remain with their mother kind of for around a year or two, and then they will have to leave. So the children could go to family members. So it could be, sometimes it might be the father, or it could be, you know, the woman's family. And sometimes the children ended up in workhouses, or in the 1860s, then they might end up in industrial schools. So they would go kind of spend time in these institutions. And then when the mother is ready, she might be able to pick them up. There's a St. Bridget's Orphanage was for Catholic children. And essentially, the children would be placed with foster families until the mother was released from prison, and then she would go and collect them. But there are just some kind of heartbreaking cases of, you know, the mothers kind of reuniting with the children who they haven't seen for years, and, you know, the child doesn't know them and hasn't been able to kind of maintain contact. I think, looking at the records, that it must have been quite hard for the mothers of quite young children behind bars, just not being able to maintain contact.
That image of of children growing up in prison is really striking, isn't it? So we were talking about prison conditions and daily routine, and I was just intrigued about how much this mirrored men's prisons at the time, or did it differ in some ways?
So we can definitely see that there's gender differences going on in prison. In a general sense, I suppose things are the same in terms of, yes, there's a uniform, there's a regimented prison day where there's work, there's this diet, there's kind of strict rules about behaviour, religious instruction and education. That's kind of the general picture. But there are distinguishing factors, and there are clear differences between the male prison and the female prison. And I suppose one of them, is what I've just mentioned about children being in the women's prison, whereas there would not be children in the male prison. That's a clear difference compared to the male prison. And for Catholic women in particular, and the prison was predominantly Catholic population, just because that reflected the general population in Ireland at that time. So religious instruction for Catholic women would involve nuns in the way that it wouldn't have for male prison. And there's also kind of gendered ideas about the type of work that's appropriate for women. And that's coming up too, laundry work, sewing, they're kind of seen as women's activities at the time. And again, I think there's ideas coming out about gendered behaviour too. So what might be, just kind of like a caution in a male prison might be punished more in a female prison, because there's that kind of sense of this isn't how a woman should behave.
You've given some great case studies and examples throughout this conversation, obviously, many of which have ended with the person going back to prison. Would that be the most common pattern, or what were some of the main things that happened to women after prison?
Yes, so very often they went back, and in many ways it's because they have already been in prison that then there's this, when they come before the judges, there's kind of that requirement that if they've been in the convict prison before, that they then have to go back again. It was kind of seen as an incentive, but a disincentive to crime. But actually, it nearly results then in there being no escape for women. For some of them, they return home and that's it. And I can kind of see them, there they are in the census, there they are 10 years later in the census again. And it seems like actually this crime for which they were in prison was kind of like, that was a one-off, they weren't a career criminal. For many of them, they actually migrate. And we can kind of understand this, it's like here's nearly a fresh start for the women. And especially it really depended on their crime. But say for some of the women who maybe had committed infanticide or maybe some kind of a violent crime, you can kind of imagine at this time that actually maybe the community wouldn't have been all that welcoming to them if they were coming back. And so several of them do migrate. There's a woman who's on the front cover of the book, Catherine Lavelle, and she is in prison. She's only a teenager. She's accused, along with her brother and her mother, of the murder of her father. So the three of them are charged, and the three of them are convicted. Now, Catherine and Thomas are convicted of manslaughter, and so they get 10 years, and the mother, she's given life in prison. So it's kind of seen like the mother is the one behind it. And through these records, we can kind of see there, Mary Lavelle, the mother, she says about how her husband was quite abusive towards her, and she actually reported him in a few days before the murder took place. So she went to the police to try to make an official statement. So Catherine Lavelle, she's one of those who's very well behaved behind bars. Her record of her behaviour is clean. There's no kind of indication that she was, talking out of turn or getting up to anything else. And so she's released, she's given early release, and she's released in 1888. And she migrates to New Jersey, and her brother is actually released early as well in order to join her, because Catherine makes an appeal, because she says, that she has grown up in rural County Mayo and she had never actually left her village before she was charged with this crime. So she has grown up in this village and never left that village, and ends up having to go across the country to the Dublin prison. And now she's going to join family members who since the crime have moved to New Jersey. But so she kind of puts forward this idea that she needs her mother to come with her because she has never been out of the country before. But in the end, it's her brother, Thomas, who goes. And eventually then in 1892, so 4 years later, the mother is released and she heads over to New Jersey as well. So we can kind of see it's as a result of this crime that family is entirely displaced to New Jersey. And you can imagine that, there is that kind of sense of not wanting to return home. And the officials, I think, were quite keen on emigration. Maybe it seemed to echo a little bit the transportation, but you can imagine that they're kind of thinking, yes, this is a fresh start. But also, if this person commits a crime, well, it's not our problem anymore, because they're actually somewhere else.
Well, obviously, from your research, you're not just looking at women in prison. You're looking at women who went to prison, but their lives as a whole. And I think that kind of takes us on to a nice final question, which would be what looking at women prisoners' experiences tells us about a much broader topic of women's lives in Ireland at the time, and the lives of those who were perhaps at the very bottom of society often.
Yes, I mean, I really, you know, it was kind of trying to get a sense of women's lives. That was really the focus of the book. And I did really want to convey those lived realities. I think through the prison records, I mean, the records are just so rich. The records that are in the National Archives of Ireland, we're really getting this view of how they survived, how they kind of, it was nearly like a patchwork sometimes of survival techniques. And sometimes that patchwork involved criminality. And then when they're behind bars, we can see who they're writing to, so we can get a sense of what their families were like. When they write their petitions to try to get out of prison early, we can see how they explain their crimes. But we can really see these kind of, where they see gender views. You know, they say like that they're a mother, or they're a daughter, and they're a sister. They have these kind of family responsibilities. And we can see that sense of family obligation coming in through the letter writing and through sometimes the visits to prison as well. We can see women's agency, you know, the roles that they're playing in the household, their roles as wives. Most of the women in the sample are unmarried, but that didn't necessarily mean that they didn't have children. So we have that kind of offers such an insight into motherhood and shows us the lengths that many of the women were going to for their children and their views. We do get such a good sense of how these institutions were connected. There's a case from 1862 where there's 14 girls and women who come from a single workhouse because of an arson attack that they committed in the South Dublin Union, South Dublin workhouse. So we can see this kind of institutionalization. And through those records, we can see that many of these girls and women have grown up in the workhouse. That is all they know. They have nowhere to go when they are released. And we can see such clear gender attitudes about what it was to be a mother in 19th century Ireland, what it was to be a wife, what it was to be a sister. And then after they're released, you know, kind of what the women go on to do and how they, I suppose, try to, in some cases, how they try to explain their actions. So in their letters then back to the prison, they're kind of talking about what they've learned. So, you know, how they have set up home, they are being a good wife, they are being a good mother, and they're trying to, of course, get their money that they have earned through their work in prison.
That was Elaine Farrell. Her book on this subject, Women, Crime and Punishment in Ireland, Life in the 19th Century Convict Prison, is out now, published by Cambridge University Press. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Ewart and Jack Bateman. Tune in tomorrow for an episode on everything you wanted to know about the Maya.